This podcast was created by Dr. Scott McLeod, Assistant Professor at the University of Minnesota and Director of the UCEA Center for the Advanced Study of Technology Leadership and Education, also known as CASEL. More information about Dr. McLeod and CASEL is available at the end of this podcast. This podcast is of a presentation at the 2006 TIES Conference in Minneapolis, Minnesota, by Amy Bissonette, who's a lawyer at Little Buffalo Law and Consulting. The title of Amy's presentation is Law and Technology, Why Legal Limits Don't Have to Limit Teaching Options. Please remember that Amy's presentation is in no way legal advice, and she and I both recommend that for any and all legal issues related to K-12 schools, that you consult a reputable school law attorney.
Okay, I think we're going to go ahead and get started. Thank you all for coming this morning. My name is Amy Bissonette. I am a lawyer and I also do some teaching. I teach at Inver Hills Community College. I also teach in the EDD program at St. Mary's University, which is how I think you ended up with having me here, because as a result of teaching at the EDD program at St. Mary's, I met Marla Davenport, and Marla called and asked, would you like to come and do a session on legal issues and technology? Obviously, I said yes. But obviously, too, I will tell you right out of the gate, I am not real tech savvy. I'm trying to learn. And I suspect that most of you in this room know a lot more about technology than I do. So what do I bring to the mix? Well, hopefully what I'm going to help you with is understanding how you can keep using the technology the way you want to use it, all those dynamic ways you're bringing it into the classroom and engaging kids, and not run afoul of the laws. All those complicated, you know, statutes and the common law issues and even just some ethical issues, the kinds of things that rise to the level of, you know, they're not really against the law, but there's something that doesn't feel right about it. I had intended today to be very interactive. Please don't just have me stand up here and speak to you for 50 minutes. That's not terribly exciting for you, and it also isn't as valuable to me, because I suspect that many of you have questions about legal issues that, although I think I've anticipated some of them, there are others that I'll miss. So please do feel free at any point to raise a hand and, you know, offer some experience that you have from the classroom, or just any other questions, comments that you have. We have at least one other lawyer in the room, and that's great, and I've already encouraged him to please pipe up and tell us, you know, if he's got a different view. As is typical with many issues in the law, you'll ask a question of a lawyer, and that very frustrating response that you commonly get is, it depends. And that's because, unfortunately, the laws are not so well crafted that we have, you know, bright lines to work with, that we know that something absolutely is a violation of copyright law. We, you know, in some instances we'd say, yeah, you're a pretty safe ground. In other instances, someone may have an experience that says, boy, I sure wasn't, and I did the same thing. So we'll talk about the gray areas. There are many of them. And again, as I said, if your experience is different than mine, please let me know. The bulk of my work in intellectual property law is with artists. I represent a lot of writers, illustrators, photographers, people in the creative field that have concerns, obviously, about their intellectual property rights and the licensing of those rights, and then need assistance with regard to contracts. So, to begin with, please, just a show of hands. How many of you are using blogs in your classrooms with students? Okay, few. How about wikis? All right. Any of you taking advantage of RSS feeds coming into your classroom? All right, so a little bit of that. How many of you have just more generic concerns with regard to internet use by students? All right. And lastly, copyright issues. Is that a concern for the group? Great, I feel better already, because that I can tell you about. Okay, we're going to start with just a slide, a quick primer on the law. When we talk about the law, of course, we have to recognize that there are many different sources of law. I've got them listed up here for you. To begin with, of course, you've got the federal and the state constitutions, the law of the land, We've got codified law. Codified is just a fancy word for statutory law. Those laws that are drafted by our legislators, ultimately approved by our governor on the state level, our president on the federal level, but those laws that are written down. And so you can turn to them and say, I know what the situation is, I know what the rule is, if the law's been written clearly enough, and that's because it's in a codified form. Common law, another name for common law is case law. This is the law that is developed on a case-by-case basis. This is judge-made law. And then the last one, the last category up there is private law. People don't commonly think of private law as a source of law. Many of you have heard about statutes, many of you are aware of case law. Private law is essentially contract law. It's the law between two parties. You and I can agree. We can enter into a contract about a particular thing, a particular subject, maybe I'm providing you a service, and the two of us can craft the rules for our engagement. And the contract that I have with you may be very different than the contract that I craft with you, and that's okay, because as long as we're dealing in a legal subject matter, and we're both competent, we have the capacity to enter into a contract, we can craft different rules and have them meet our situation. That's private law. Particularly contract law. And that's one area where we're going to spend a little bit of time today, because for those of you who are concerned about what do we do with particular student assignments, how do we get parents on board, how do we get the administration on board, how do we make sure students understand what their obligations are, a lot of that has to do with that private law arena. All right, constitutional law. Big issue here, of course, is free speech. And it cuts a couple different ways. Free speech, to begin with, is what allows people to put things out on the internet that we really would just assume our children never saw. However, assuming something is legal, it's not obscene, it's not child pornography, free speech allows people to put things out there, to post things on websites, and then of course raises the issue of if we've got kids out there surfing the net, boy, they're going to come across some stuff, unless we're using filters, unless we're actively monitoring. They're going to come across some stuff that we just assume they didn't come across. Our country happens to believe that this is very important, though, for a number of reasons. We don't want to get rid of free speech. We've got this balancing act going on. Free speech becomes an issue with regard to students, too, when students have weblogs, and whether they are blogs that they are using in conjunction with a class assignment, or what if it's a blog that is their own? It's a Facebook site or a MySpace site. What can a student say that's okay? There was recently a case involving a Pennsylvania teenager who was suspended from school because he used his personal blog, his MySpace, or I don't remember if it was MySpace or Facebook site, to say some rather disparaging things about his school's principal. It's a free speech issue. Is he allowed to do that on his own personal blog? Arguably, yes. Could he do that on a school server? No, at least not if the school has taken the time to put in its acceptable use policy or someplace else on among its policies and procedures that any space offered by the school is a limited forum with regard to free speech issues.
So yes. You're saying that if they do this at home, and they put it on MySpace account or on their blog, they can't. But if they do it in school, on the school's computer, they can't.
Okay, and the question is it okay for kids, am I really making that distinction, that at home they can put anything they want up there on the school server, there are limitations? Using a school computer, ooh, that's a great question. That's a nice mixed question. The server space is not the school's. The place where the kid is posting the disparaging remarks is not the school's. But he's using school computers, school hardware, to access his site during school time. Again, it's going to matter. What does your school policy say? And could you set limits on the use of, what's appropriate use of school computers? Absolutely. And in fact, most school acceptable use policies talk about how students certainly can't make commercial use of the school's computers. They can't be going on eBay during the lunch hour. It would be wise to also say that you can't be accessing your personal account. Now, we can't prevent the kid from going home and posting things on a blog that is not on a school server. And that's the distinction. Doesn't mean that anything is fair game. When we get to common law, we'll talk about libel, slander, defamation, and all those fun kinds of legal issues. All right, codified law, statutory law. I've got the main ones, kind of the heavy hitters listed up there. First one is the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. This was is a piece of legislation that said that you have to be very careful if you are a web hoster, someone who owns a website, about the information that you collect from children electronically, children who are visiting your site. And in fact, if you want to collect information from children, there are many instances in which you need to obtain parental permission before you can do that. The second one, the Children's Internet Protection Act, is probably one that you are all very familiar with. This is the piece of legislation that ties federal school funding to the use of filters on computers in schools and libraries. All right, so in order to get the federal funding, you have to agree to have certain filters on your school computer. The third one, the Deleting Online Predators Act. This is proposed legislation. Has anybody heard about this legislation? This is one that is, there's a House version of this right now. It has, as far as I'm aware, there's not a Senate version yet. It was anticipated that the Senate would actually take this up this past fall, and it did not. This is a controversial bill. It's controversial because, like CIPA, the Children's Internet Protection Act, it ties federal funding for schools to certain things that schools have to do. And what DOPA is suggesting is that schools need to block certain sites. So we've already got CIPA that says you've got to have filters. Now DOPA is proposing that you actually block sites. What kind of sites? We're talking about a lot of those social networking sites. It requires schools and libraries to block access to a wide range of internet content, and the term is so broadly defined that it includes social networking sites like MySpace and Facebook, online email, instant messaging, wikis, and blogs. Now, this pertains to schools and public libraries that are receiving federal funding. This is, according to the American Library Association, overreaching. There's some real concerns about the fact that this will so severely limit access for students, and particularly students in rural areas or low-income areas, people who don't have home computers, who need to go to the public library to use a computer, or who rely on their school computers. Now you've got a whole class of kids who are not going to be able to participate in some of the social networking that their friends do, but also are not going to be able to access a lot of good educational content. As I said, the ALA is actively trying to work against this legislation, and if it's something that you're not terribly aware of, I encourage you to either go to the American Library Association site or do some other research on it. Part of your job as educators in this arena, educators who want to be able to use technology with your kids, is to keep on top of legislation, and particularly when it's potentially overreaching legislation, as at least personally I believe DOPA is, and a number of other professionals believe it to be as well. Yes?
Do you have any feel for the climate around this and whether it seems likely to pass, or is it too early to say?
The question is whether I have any feel for whether this is likely to pass or not. I honestly don't, not personally. I am pleased that it was anticipated that the Senate was going to take it up in the fall, and the Senate did not. There are problems with a lot of this codified law because, let's face it, politicians being politicians, a lot of the proposed legislation that is out there, and even some that has been passed, is very partisan in nature, and sometimes somebody's individual agenda gets wrapped up in the law. And so you end up with a law like COPPA and the Communications Decency Act, which was the law that preceded COPPA, that end up being constitutionally challenged even once they're enacted, because somebody has put terms in there that would make it violate, arguably violate free speech issues, or again, just make it overreaching. It's more legislation than we need. If the intent is to protect kids, then it could have been done in a simpler format. So I suspect DOPA's got some real hurdles, but don't know at this point what'll happen with it. The other two areas of codified law, of course, involve copyright law. The copyright law itself, which includes the TEACH Act amendments, and then, of course, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Common law, case law. What else do we need to be worried about on the internet? If the preceding category of laws, the statutory laws, are the kinds of laws that administrators and teachers are looking at to make sure that we're all toeing the line and we're acting appropriately with regard to school use of computers, this is maybe the area where we most need to alert our students to the fact that there are legal pitfalls out there for them. They can't write whatever the heck they want on their blogs and suffer no consequences. So this is a wonderful teaching arena for you in school, both with regard to teaching kids how to use school technology, where they actually are using the school server, but also when they go home and they start to put things on their Facebook site. Libel, slander, invasion of privacy, unfair competition, and right to publicity. If you post something libelous or slanderous about someone else on your blog site, there can be repercussions. Civil lawsuits can be brought against you, money damages can be sought. Anytime you put something up there that is potentially damaging to somebody else's reputation. Yes?
Callum, there were a few websites that we could rate professors and how they were, and they were outside of what the school had.
Mm-hmm.
What if there was something similar with teachers in high school or grade school even? Would that fall under the slander or?
Oh, that's a great question. His question, he said that in college there were some websites you could go to and you could actually rate your professors. And says, what if there was an equivalent for high school teachers or middle school teachers? And you know what? There is. There are. I suspect there are multiple sites. And I know because my kids go there, I'm sorry to say. Just because you put something up there that is your opinion and maybe less than flattering doesn't necessarily mean that you have risen to the level of a defamation case, a libel or a slander case. However, again, you've got to be careful. Your opinion is one thing. Stating something to be true that you know is not true and is disparaging of the teacher or the principal, now that's a problem, and civil penalties could follow. Yes?
I have a question about that. Can the school then
can the school discipline kids for posting something that's unflattering about a teacher, or does it have to be a private lawsuit? Again, it depends. To begin with, it depends on whose equipment are we using. If we're using home equipment, not school equipment, okay, so that helps the student out. You're not using a school server, you're not using a school computer. Short of it being something false, something defamatory, it really becomes a free speech issue. Now, that's the legal response. The legal response is the kid may absolutely have every legal right to put something unflattering about a teacher on his or her blog. What's the real response, though? What's the practical response? Do we want kids doing this? Are there likely to be repercussions for that kid, even if there are no civil penalties, even if there's no lawsuit brought? Oh, yeah. Kids need to understand that teachers are out on the internet, too. That if you learn that you've got a kid who's put something disparaging on a website about a fellow teacher, you may not think favorably of that kid. So that's one of those sort of, legally, the kid might have a good ground, good leg to stand on. Ethically, is that the way we want kids to operate? Because let's face it, they are using this technology day in and day out. They know it better than we do. But they don't necessarily have a good ethical barometer. They don't necessarily know when they have crossed that line. And it's not just with regard to stuff that they're posting about other people. How many kids are posting photographs or news about parties on their blogs? Do they realize that, future employers can get a hold of that stuff? All right, and then, yes?
Change in the relative to my interest in the government.
change with regard to minors, if we're dealing with minors, somebody under 18? The answer is no. Criminal law certainly does. We know we treat kids differently when they're under a certain age from a criminal law perspective. And that's because of the penalties associated with criminal law. If you violate a criminal law and you are found guilty, you potentially could suffer a loss of liberty. All right, so not just a fine, not just an inconvenience. Civil law is different. Now, does that mean that a judge or jury would not take into account a kid's age? They certainly would. And there was a recent case involving a kid who put the lyrics to a song on his website. And they were really inappropriate lyrics. It had something from the movie Johnny Dangerously. And let me see if I've got it right here for you. Something about I have a gun that can shoot through a school. It was pretty harsh, and I'm not able to put it. It's here somewhere. But essentially, he put something on his website that was inappropriate for him to put on it. Now, there not only were school authorities alarmed, but arguably he was in violation of a criminal law, the Safe Schools Act. However, the upshot of it was the school decided not to press charges, didn't want to follow up on it, understanding that he was a minor and that it was something inappropriate, but also done by a kid who wasn't thinking. So that kind of thought process you could very easily find among members of a jury or a judge. Okay? So what falls into the private law category? What can you do? What can you best do? Assuming you're following all the codified law, you've got the internet filters in place, you've educated kids and your colleagues about the dangers of common law violations, the libel, the slander, the invasion of privacy. What's the best way for you to protect yourself if you want to do some fun stuff in the classroom? If you want kids to be able to use technology, understanding you cannot control all the risks, that's where private law comes in. This is why schools have drafted acceptable use policies. How many of your schools have acceptable use policies? Of course you do. How many of them are age specific, have different policies depending on the age of the kid? A few of you. That's actually a really nice feature, something that you might want to encourage your administration to consider, because you know that the kind of access that you would grant a kid in the K through 2 or K through 3 arena is much different than what you're going to allow your high school students. Acceptable use policies, great start. Parent permission slips. The more you tell the parents about what you're doing, and not just about the risks, but selling them on the benefits of the technology that you're using in the classroom. And then you get documentation that the parents have agreed. The more you do that, the better off you are. A lot of this just has to do with increasing understanding. So being very candid about what you're doing, what the student is going to be allowed to access, what the benefits are, inviting parent feedback and questions, and then getting the parent to sign off. Even if the parent has already signed an acceptable use policy, you know, this may sound redundant, but the lawyer in me tells you, go ahead, do it again. You're planning on building a wiki in your classroom? Let the parents know what a wiki is. Tell them what this involves and get them to sign off on it. Obviously, the other piece to this puzzle is getting your students to sign off on what they think their obligations are. And then, as I said, age-specific policies make a lot of sense.
What is your deal on, we have a student handbook, and the only way that we have the parents sign off is if they don't want the child to be online.
The question says that, this fellow indicates that they've got an acceptable use policy, it's in the student handbook, and the only time you require a signature is if the parents want to opt out. They don't want their child to have access. You know, that's okay. It really is. And I suspect that the lawyers advising your schools came to that same conclusion. Lord knows it's hard sometimes to get permission slips back. So much paper especially goes home with kids at the beginning of the year that getting it back and getting everything signed can be difficult. So, not a bad way to approach it. Bless you. And is it something that you could later, based on your experience, decide to change? You know, if you've got a lot of parents who are later alleging, I didn't know anything about this, you know, I just encourage you to revisit that policy. That's true of all the policies that you are institutionalizing at your school. For no other reason, the policy that was written 2 years ago probably doesn't address some of the technology that we have today.
I just have to talk about that.
Yeah.
In the school district that I work with, we have that happen. Where we have parents not only weren't getting those at home, some of our schools have reversed that. Because if kids aren't getting home, there's this assumption being made they might not have ever received a notification on time. The other thing that happened in the schools that I worked with was there was parenthood were illiterate. And that came into play in effect on some issues with planning with their students. So, you know, I consider multiple ways of getting access to parents to sign off. And lots of times people are doing presentations now at parent meetings so that people can come in and hear classrooms. The first time these parent-teacher conferences and you're sitting down face-to-face, having the teacher go through this as part of parent-teacher conferences the first time. Some of our schools are trying some other things because, you know, there's a lot of assumptions being made that those notes and stuff are really at home and they just go out from there.
Now, and let me just please, for the benefit of those who may not have heard, I'm going to try to capture everything you said. She made some wonderful arguments in favor of redundant mechanisms. She said that her school initially had a similar policy as to this gentleman's where they sent material home and said, if you don't sign, if you don't affirmatively opt out, we will assume that you are in agreement. They changed that policy as a result of parents later saying, I never saw that piece of paper, or maybe I didn't understand it. Parents might be illiterate. Parents may not speak English well. You can have other kinds of barriers to understanding. And so then what her additional comments related to the fact that they try at every juncture to inform parents about the policy. And this doesn't just isn't just limited to acceptable use policies. Obviously, anything you're doing in the school, if you want parents informed, then at the parent-teacher conferences you tell them, at school assemblies that they may be invited to you tell them. So you keep trying to pound home that this is what we're doing and please understand what we're doing and please agree, and if you don't, let us know. There was a comment back here.
I was wondering if when you send out, you put it on the web and you say, please check if this is acceptable or something, and you've got a website, Gathered Education, with their name attached to the box that they're checking, is that legal?
Is it legal? She asked, could you have this parent check off on a website? And would that be legal? Sure, it's, you know, any way that you're trying to solicit parent feedback and permission, you can do it in a number of different ways, and obviously if you're talking technology, you want to do it on a website, that's okay too. You're bound to miss somebody somewhere. So, you know, do you still follow up, as this woman indicated, with other opportunities to let parents know what's going on? I would encourage you to do that. If you miss one or two, you know, then of course you have to deal with that situation as it arises. But you can indicate both with regard to whether, you know, it's a handbook or other checkoffs or a website checkoff. At least that indicates a good faith effort on your part to inform parents.
So I guess what I was thinking about is the kids who go on to
that. Exactly.
And Mark, I think it was a hand brought in at the signature. I was just wondering if there would be
there's always recourse. She says, you know, a kid could go on to, if you had a web checkoff, a kid could go in and check it off on in lieu of the parents doing it with or without parents' permission. You're right. And any of these mechanisms, you know, the paper going home, some of them don't come back. The webs, the opt-out only affirmatively, some people are going to miss that. A web checkoff, it could be abused. You've got to make your best effort. Realizing, of course, that what the original premise, the thing that you are trying to put out there to begin with, is legal. You have dotted all your I's and crossed your T's with regard to what your responsibilities are under codified law and under common law. Yes?
I think your previous slide referred to slander, libel, and other general nastiness. How do you, where a student damages the professional reputation of a teacher? That stigma has been carried on for years and actually affects employability. At what point does that cross the line and where is that?
The question is, at what point do students cross a line? At what point can a teacher take recourse against a student that has damaged the teacher's reputation? You know, and that, again, that depends. But if I had a student out there posting things on a website about me that was ultimately affecting my livelihood, affecting my job, affecting my potential for promotion, or even just damaging my reputation with other parents, not seeing me credibly as the instructor, at some point the level of personal harm rises to, it rises to a certain level that you are indeed experiencing damages under the law. Damages being the kind of thing for which you would seek, if not monetary compensation, you would perhaps seek an injunction, some kind of mechanism that would force a student to take something down. It's a tough call if what the student is doing is on his or her own space, and if it is viewed as free speech, as opinion, that isn't necessarily going to get you into court on a libel or slander case. If the student is divulging something about you that's personal and private, you might have an invasion of privacy suit. But what I would encourage any teacher to do at a point where life is getting uncomfortable because that sort of thing is happening is to consult with an attorney, a personal injury attorney, probably. Yes?
But the acceptable use policies and the paraprofessional slips that come back, our concern is the number of them could be enforced. That's the biggest issue.
The comment is that parent permission slips can be forged. Absolutely. As I said, you're not going to be able to ensure 100% compliance. You cannot be certain that your piece of paper was signed by the parent any more than you can say that the box on the website was checked off by the parent. You've got to make your best efforts, and you've got to document your best efforts. So what do? You do something. You do something that rises to the level of, it's the kind of thing that would put most of us on notice. Are you going to miss some people? Yes. But then if those missed few, those disgruntled parents come in and say, I didn't know this was going on, at least you're not backpedaling saying, geez, I should have told you. You're standing firm from, well, we sent notices out. I understand you didn't get it, and let's work from there. So you're in a better
position. Well, we take the stand that it was returned, and there is a signature in that space.
Yep.
How do you know that wasn't your signature?
And you're certainly within your rights to do that. He says, we take the stand that as long as that paper was returned and it was signed, it's not your job to be suspicious of who signed it. Yep, exactly. All right, so with regard to the laws and technology, what are some areas of concern? Well, obviously, we've got to have balance. We need to be concerned from a policy standpoint. Are our laws sufficient to cover the risk, but not so overreaching that they are harming opportunities? They are harming access. And arguably, that's what's going on with DOPA, with the proposed legislation that is DOPA. That, it's one thing to want to protect kids, but when you start saying that the kids in the middle school and the high school cannot access wikis and blogs and, have their own Facebook sites, is that really accomplishing legislative intent to protect them? Or, and even if it is it still so overreaching because then we know we've got a whole body of kids who no longer now have good access to the internet? Knee-jerk legislation, arguably again the DOPA situation. People are unhappy about what's happening on the internet, whether it's cyberbullying or whether it's online predators, and we all should definitely be concerned about that. That doesn't necessarily mean, though, that legislation is the fix. What other ways do you help deal with that with your students? Education, absolutely. Your biggest charge is to help these kids figure out how to safely navigate the internet. And you as teachers are in a wonderful position to do that. And not only to talk to them about where they shouldn't go, but to be the outlet for them and to tell them, come to me if something inappropriate happens to you. If somebody posts something on your blog that is wrong, that is, it makes you uncomfortable, that is sexually explicit, you come to me. I will help you deal with that. And that's, of course, the third bullet, this notion that you cannot rely exclusively on laws to deal with these issues. There's an analogy, the National Academy of Science did a big report, and one of the analogies that it threw out there, and you probably have all heard this, is the swimming pool analogy. If you have a swimming pool in your backyard, you put a fence around it, maybe you put a lock on the gate, you make sure you got a life preserver or one of those long poles. That's the equivalent of the laws. You build in the safety features that you can. But ultimately, you also need those kids to know how to swim. Isn't that one of your best defenses against something bad happening in the pool? I threw this slide in here just to help us all think, or perhaps to not think egocentrically. It's I get on my bandwagon, and I'm very certain of my own point of view, as I'm sure many of you are. But we have to acknowledge that in this scenario, we've got a number of different parties involved and a number of different points of view we need to consider. We cannot overlook the fact that the federal government provides essential funding to schools. And so the federal government has to have some voice in this. School administrators arguably are between a rock and a hard place. You know, school administrators have to be the ones policing, are the filters installed, are appropriate policies being written, but then also have to be responsive to the concerns of teachers who want to introduce some great technology to the classroom. The teachers are up there, the parents are up there, the students are up there, and then, of course, the greater online community. We don't have great rules, ethical rules, written anywhere, or arguably, I don't know if written is the right word, captured anywhere on the web, that people follow uniformly about what makes for good online behavior. So again, we're back to this notion that if we are teaching kids well about how to behave online, how to stay within legal limits and arguably within ethical limits, don't we end up serving the entire online community? So what do? Well, you got to comply with the laws. We know that. Education is probably your biggest piece. And you're not just educating the students. That's your primary charge, but you're educating parents, you're educating administration, you're educating fellow teachers, and then you're working on those private law solutions. All right, so let's work with some scenarios. And if you've got, there was a sheet that I passed out. If anybody needs it, do you know where the extras are? There's some extras in the back. They're the same scenarios that I'll have up here on the screen, but just if you want to be able to read along. Okay, here's our first scenario. Starting in the elementary school, pretty simple use of technology. We've got a school where students have typically, you know, over the years, in third and fourth grade, students have been involved with an authors in residence program. Children's writer comes in, works with the kids in the school, the kids all work on their own stories, and, you know, typically what happens, or at least historically what has happened as a result of this kind of program, is that the kids then put together a little book, right? They have a hard copy book, they illustrate the cover, it's very nice. The teachers in this school, though, they want to do something a little more tech savvy, and so what they're proposing is that this year, we're going to have the kids read their stories, create podcasts, and then we will post those podcasts on the school website so grandma can listen, and, you know, somebody, a relative that lives in Texas can listen, and other kids can listen to other kids' stories, and maybe we'll even do some readings of the author's work. All right, what are the legal issues associated with this scenario? Copyright is the first one, good. Copyright if you're reading the author's work, but also the kids are writing their own stories. They have copyright, they're owners of the copyright in their own stories. All right, what other issues? Yes. Student information. How are you going to identify these kids? When you post these podcasts on the website, what kind of identifying information will you use? So grandma knows that this is her grandson's story, but the rest of the world doesn't know much about this kid or where he or she lives. All right, so we hit on a couple of them. The safety issue is a biggie. You have to be responsive to the fact that you can't put probably more than a first name. If you have, your child has a unique name, you probably want to give that kid a pseudonym, something that will not make that kid stand out. Because anybody else who comes to the website already knows that there's a child in third or fourth grade at this particular school. And you can't, you know, you don't want to provide any more identifying information than that. The copyright issue. If you own a copyright, you create something, you have the copyright in it, you are the one who can decide whether it can be copied, whether it can be distributed, whether it can be performed, whether somebody else can create a derivative work out of it, correct? So, right out of the gate, if you want to read some of the visiting author's stories, you've got to get his or her permission. If you want to put the kids' stories out there, the kids own the copyrights in their own stories. You can be a minor and own copyright. Yes. Was that your question? Oh, okay. So the kids have their own copyright interest in those stories. You may want to put a notice on the website that says all rights reserved. We want to protect the copyright in these kids' stories. Yeah.
I teach media arts. Mm-hmm. School setting and the things we make
videos
and do lots of different things. So I have a relationship with the arts library.
Yes.
Are we using that appropriately? Can we put those on the internet?
Whoa, boy, here's a great question. This is a fair use question. Educators have some leeway with regard to the copyright law, but oftentimes not as much as you think you do. There was a presentation in this room immediately before this one where one of the teachers showed something, I think similar to what you're describing. It was a media arts presentation that one of her kids had put together, had tons of images in it. All copyrighted images contained in this student's presentation. And there was a soundtrack, the entire length of a song, copyrighted song. Now, can you do that? Can a kid do that for a classroom project? Under the fair use criteria, I think you're in pretty good shape. Because fair use looks at, you know, the nature of the work that you are using. This was pretty highly creative work, and so that cut against the student. But the purpose was educational, nonprofit, so that works. The third criterion is how much of the work are you using, the amount and substantiality. Again, student used 100% of a lot of copyrighted works. Did it affect the marketability of those works? That's the fourth criterion, probably not. So all in all, the student's probably in decent shape for the classroom. But now you're talking about putting it on the web. And there you might run into issues. Now, one of the exhibitors in the other room said to me during the break, as long as you're not making money off of it, nobody will care. Maybe, maybe not. Okay, that used to be a pretty good rule of thumb. You could say, you know, our student's not making money off of it. It's not a problem. No one's going to claim infringement. Nowadays, when you see particularly the record companies going after anybody who downloads even a small amount of material, I'm not sure we can stand by that.
So, am I right in telling my students that the school has to own the music?
That the school has to own the music. Are you right in telling your students? The students can use it for a classroom presentation, I think, within fair use bounds, even if the school doesn't own the music. And when you say own it, you mean the school has a licensed right to use the music. Yes. Then you're a safe ground. I mean, the best thing you can do is either obtain material via a licensing agreement so you know you can use it, or obtain individual permission from people.
Well, we're not doing that. If I go out and buy a movie or download
a movie, I just want to know if I'm a library. Okay, the question is, if I buy a CD and bring it in, you know, you don't buy the copyright. You buy the music, you've got the CD. Can the students use that? Again, only within very limited, you know, within the classroom, yeah. But they can't, once they stick it out on the web, now you've got a whole different audience and arguably greater claims for an infringement. Yes? You can buy royalty-free music, and there's music in the public domain. This gentleman had a question, hang on.
You talked about encryption before.
Yes.
Let's say that your story is essentially browser to browser. You want the kids learning, and you want to create a book for the kids where you use basically a story. You scroll that the author wrote it and everything, but you use different graphics and the bear reference. You go ahead and color that for different objects, and you want to do that. Now, that violates copyright because you're citing that it came from this person. You're making it somewhat different.
Mm-hmm.
The kids are making a book now, but you're basically doing it.
This is a question with regard to derivative works, and can I take a story, an illustrated kid's story, use the author's text, and have kids do new pictures, for instance?
Either they color pictures or draw
They color pictures or draw their own. That is still a derivative work. Got a couple different things going on. There's a copyright in the book. The author, the person who wrote the text, owns a copyright in the text. There arguably was another illustrator who owned the copyright in those pictures. Now you're saying, can I substitute the pictures out? It's still a derivative work. You by copyright do not have the right to create a derivative work out of that. But let's again consider the realm in which you are using it. If you're using it for a classroom activity, do you have a fair use argument? Probably. You know, what other alternatives do you have? You could get permission from the author to use the book in that way, explaining be right up front about this is a very limited use, it's never going to leave the classroom. You could do it once, kind of under the argument that this was a spontaneous a lesson plan, but then next year you can't do it again unless you get permission. Lots of fair use rules. And just, we're not going to make it to the end, are we? Okay, all right, which is fine, go ahead.
Big battle with high school yearbook productions.
Okay.
Videos, the music of their year is so embedded in how they want to picture that.
Yeah.
So coming up with, you know, generic music is really not what they want to do. Fair use, they want to use whole songs. So I'm always battling them.
Yes, this is a question about high school yearbook productions, and these kids want to use full-length songs to supplement their video yearbooks. And you know what? My argument would be, tell these kids, if they are aspiring journalists, many of them probably are, that's why they're working on yearbook, you know, they've got to understand the rules of the game. And it's not fair use to use an entire song. Those yearbooks are sold, maybe not for profit, but, you know, they are outside of a fair use, mainly because, you know, they're, number one, the nature of the work they're using, highly creative. Number two, the purpose of their use, not exactly nonprofit or purely educational. Substantiality, amount of substantiality, they're using the entire song. And does it affect the marketability? I don't know. Would a kid go out and buy a CD, but then he or she says, I got that music on my video yearbook? Which then they copy and put on something else anyway. You know, that's a problem. There's not a good fair use argument there. Yes?
Do you have any suggestions in terms of a mechanism by which you can get permission from recording companies?
The short answer is yes. Let me offer a couple of suggestions to you because I know we're running out of time. The Minnesota State Colleges and Universities have two websites. One is an IP website, one is a copyright website. I'm sorry I don't have the URL available, but if you go to either the MinSCU home site or you Google MinSCU and copyright, they'll come up. They are text-heavy websites. They're not going to be terribly appealing to your students, but there's a lot of great educational material there for you as educators. And how do you obtain permission? How much of something arguably can you use and still be within the bounds of fair use? There are a lot of scenarios that are in there so that you can kind of test your knowledge. So that's one place to look, the Minnesota State. It's the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. MinSCU is the abbreviation, MNSCU. And these are two websites that were put together by the Chancellor's Office. One's particularly on intellectual property and the other one is on copyright. And they are written with teachers in mind. And although the audience that they were originally written for are higher ed teachers, the issues are the same. Yes?
Can you imagine the entire use of the song? Is there different models to use in the handbook?
Don't we wish? There aren't, although many of your school policies probably incorporate kind of those guidelines, and in fact the MinSCU site has guidelines as well where, you know, 30 seconds of a song would probably be okay. Here's the reason why, in a nutshell, why we don't have anything hard and fast to deal with when we're talking about amount and substantiality. Gerald Ford wrote a memoir, President Ford. There was one thing in that book that everybody wanted to know. What was it? Why he pardoned Nixon, okay? So Gerald Ford writes his memoirs. He's not the most exciting president we had, but everyone wanted to know why he pardoned Nixon. A reviewer put a review of that book out before the book was released, and took just a very small piece of that book, like one paragraph, right? What paragraph was it? Why he pardoned Nixon, okay? And so from the standpoint of fair use, do we usually allow people to review books? Absolutely. Do we let them use excerpts? Yes. But amount and substantiality, when you take the key piece, that greatly affected the marketability of his book. And so he and his publisher, of course, were very happy with the result of their infringement claim against the reviewer. Yes?
What if like general teachers, not first grade teachers, they each have the same 100 books and they want to make recordings of those to the kids to listen to them while reading the books?
Oh boy, the question is what if we have 100 books and we want to make a recording of the book so the kids can listen to them while they're reading? You don't have permission under the copyright law now to copy someone else's work. And to copy it into another format is even more problematic. Could you make a fair use argument? Again, first time you do it in the classroom, you decide, oh, let's do this, this will be great fun. You know, you might be able to get away with a spontaneity kind of argument. After that, you decide you want to do that again next year as part of your lesson plan. You got to get permission. That's just the way it is. Yes?
Online courses.
Online courses.
Can a teacher scan an article, say, just as an example?
Uh-huh. Okay, the question is, on an online course, may I scan an entire article from a password-protected site? I own the magazine. It's a password-protected website that the online course is on.
Right.
This is a TEACH Act question. What can you do if you otherwise comply with all the requirements of the TEACH Act? Can you scan an entire article and put it out there online for your students in this password-protected group? The first time, yes. After that, again, if you want to continue to reuse something, you need permission, because although the TEACH Act gives you opportunities to convey some things to students electronically that didn't used to exist, you still have to come down to a fair use analysis with some of these types of things. The other thing is that the TEACH Act, for instance, whatever you put out there is supposed to be part of systematic, mediated instructional activity, which means that you give your students something that they would do if they were in the classroom right in front of you. If you're putting that article out there because you want them to read it later, now it's not covered by TEACH Act, so you have to look at a fair use analysis. And so again, I would say first time spontaneous use, it's absolutely relevant to what you're teaching now, go ahead, let them look at it. If you want to keep it as part of your teaching for semesters to come, you got to get permission. Yeah.
If I have a video class and the kids are using their own pictures, so that's fine.
Yep.
And then they saw some pictures that the local newspaper had taken out of the football game. Mm-hmm. They used it, they're only going to show it in class.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, fine, but you must cite the newspaper at the end of the video.
Mm-hmm.
Then they want to put newspaper. And so they must cite the authors of the newspaper. And now they want to put it on the web. Now I have some problems. Is citing it enough?
Great question. Thank you for asking this, and then I know we're out of time. Two issues going on here, plagiarism and copyright. If you cite the original source, you're fine from a plagiarism standpoint. That's what you take care of. You've given the appropriate acknowledgement to the person who originally took that photo, but you have not taken care of your copyright concerns. So, I agree with your analysis. Let them use it in the classroom. That's great. They put it out there on the web, now they got a problem. And I'll also tell you that if it's a local newspaper, we have some local newspapers that are very diligent about policing their copyrights. So, you could get a nasty letter. Okay? We're out of time. If you have other questions, I am still going to be here, so come on up. Thank you all for your attention. Yes, you want to, can I post it? Absolutely.
I don't have a handout for this one.
You're right, I didn't put it on the handout because I thought we'd actually talk about it. Post them on my website, or?
Put them up here, and I'll show them on there.
Okay, so this is the weather wiki was? Wikis, of course, the issue is that you've got soft security. You're letting kids come in and edit things, and does that raise issues with regard to what they might put out there? Well, not just incorrect information, but nasty kind of information. Or will they go in and delete information? And oftentimes with wikis, they borrow. They tend to take a photo from a website or to take other material, which arguably infringes copyright. And then, do you want to see the next one already? Or okay. And then, whoops. I'm sorry. I should have just put it on the handout. I thought we'd have time. I can also give this to Marla Davenport. I don't know if they're posting stuff from this conference.
I think they are.
Then I will give her the site or the whole thing with the answer.
Okay.
And then the high school one. Huge safety issue, of course, when you've got kids blogging. And real potential for them to say things that are out of line and arguably invade the privacy of others. You also need to check your acceptable use policies. A lot of them may not even mention kids publishing stuff on the web because blogs were not a big part of our world even a few years ago. And then obviously if you're asking them to participate in a blog as part of an educational venture and they don't have access to a computer, you got a problem here. Yeah.
Quick question for my fair use. Mm-hmm. Because I've heard you answer this before, but there's still some debate.
Okay.
Both ethically and legally. The biggest thing I'm sure all teachers do wrong is when PowerPoint starts to be popular, it's really time saving to just go into Google Images and steal them. Uh-huh. And I know that's unethical. You post it, you give them credit, mm-hmm. you've removed some of the ethical issues,
yep.
you know, because now no one's going to look at the references, but they're there if
they're
they
there.
Wanted to
yeah.
see them. Legally, I understand that you have the spontaneity is a big part of it. One of my colleagues asked, well, what if this is a continual thing that you do?
Mm-hmm.
So every time I make that presentation, I always go and I steal the images. Mm-hmm. I haven't stolen that person's image before. And and in theory, I'm using it just this one year, because
yep.
next year I'll edit it and I'll
yep.
change it a little bit.
Okay.
Now, number one, if I leave the picture in there the second year without seeking the author's permission, mm-hmm. I'm legally...
Yeah.
I mean, I understand what are the odds of that person right. catching me using it in my classroom. I'm not posting it to the web.
Right, and caring. Not only catching you, but caring
right.
that you use
right.
it. Yes.
But technically, if I use it that second year, yeah. then I'm out of the bounds of what's legal
you
for
are.
Fair use.
You are, because you had adequate time to try to get permission to use that
right.
image. It's not spontaneous anymore. You're using the entire image. Now, you know, the trouble with relying on a fair use analysis is that means you're in trouble. You know, fair use is a defense. And so I always encourage people to take advantage of whatever you've got, licensed material that's available to you at school, to go to those websites like OpenCourseWare websites or Merlot kind of websites where you've got individual contributors who are more than happy to give you permission to use their stuff for educational purposes. Do you use learning object repositories when you go looking for images?
Sometimes.
Because that's, you know, that's a real good source for educators of stuff that can be used without strings attached.
Like Merlot.
Yeah. Merlot is a good one. And then, as I said, the open courseware sites like MIT has it. A whole bunch of colleges and universities have it. The University of Michigan, I think, is just converting everything over.
What would be a good search for those? For those images? What would learning?
I would just...
if I was going to seek out and use that as a resource for my teachers, if I said, here's a place you can go to start finding legal images.
Well, Merlot, you know, is a good one, but you have to look at each individual contributor's
right.
Grant of permission. Any of the learning object repository might be a term that you could Google. Also, just start with MIT, their open courseware site, or anything that has a Creative Commons licensing agreement attached to it, because then it is creative. There's a lot of, do you know where that originated, the whole Creative Commons thing? Many different learning objects.
The blessing, I think, was the Creative Commons. I mean, the best source for open images is Flickr.
Flickr?
Flickr is also banned by a lot of districts. So.
Yeah. So
but the teachers, my district teachers have an influence instead of restriction.
Absolutely. Flickr is the best source.
Flickr?
Of
F-L-I-C-K-R. C-K-R, yeah,
everybody,
no E.
It's a photo sharing site.
Okay.
This is for tagging the San Antonio, and you get everybody's picture that they ever took of San Antonio. It's all right there.
And they're putting it out there because when they put it on Flickr, there's this implied licensing agreement that anybody...
Well, but they can, I mean, they show the license, you know, the license of the buyer.
At the last minute.
Yeah.
That's not a defense, is it?
Oh, I don't know. Is there a defense for the ill-prepared?
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I mean,
well...
This is, of course, the gamble back to the wood they catch.
But exactly.
This, ethically speaking, is that under fair use? Is that a fair use right? I can steal it because it's last minute, but
it's
I do
like,
it every single time.
You're not reusing images. I mean, there is something that, there is that requirement, or excuse me, that criteria, that whole spontaneity and brevity, and, you know, just follow your gut on some of that stuff. You're using it for the kind of purpose that very few people are going to take issue with to begin with.
That's what I think.
Yeah, yeah. And for your students, the main thing I think is tell them, well, what we do in the classroom is okay because we're doing it in the classroom. But if you want to take it home and put it on your MySpace page, then you might have an issue.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks. Appreciate the talk today.
Question.
Yeah.
When our students are doing a podcast of a book review, can you put up a little cover just as an image at the beginning of the podcast? Or?
You know, this is a great question because, you know, Amazon puts a book cover out there, and arguably, you know, it's copy, it's protected by copyright. Now, you're using it for an educational purpose or a editorial purpose. Anyway, in that vein, I think it would be okay. You know who that'd be a great question for? Do you know anything about the Children's Literature Network?
A little about that.
Vicki Palmquist runs the Children's Literature Network, and they're just at childrensliteraturenetwork.org. And so what you want is you want your kids to be able to do podcasts and to put, and just accompany the podcast to have, And because Vicki uses photo, or uses images of covers all the time when she reviews books on CNN. And that's, you know, it used to be a nonprofit, now it's a for-profit entity. But that, you know, the only issue you would have is again, the illustrator who did the cover of the book is going to be using all of it, and yet all the other fair use criteria are going up. With what you're worried about as far as the nature, the purpose of your use, you're not going to affect the marketability. You're going to enhance the marketability of this book, arguably. And you're putting it on a school website? So I think I would tell you that if you're going to put a thumbnail up there, you're just going to something that I couldn't take a big image of.
Like a nice hanging thumbnail for the podcast.
Yep.
Okay. The other question, I work in the professional development department, so sometimes teachers make a video of a student doing reading. And then they bring that sometimes to the district and show it to the other teachers.
Oh, with student permission?
I'm not sure in all cases. If they have a parent permission slip, is it okay to do that even though it's not part of their classroom?
Yeah, they made the video, the teacher made the video of the student.
Yeah.
Then what you're worried about are privacy issues for the student. And so as long as, because the copyright resides with the teacher who put the videotape together. And so the student needs to give you permission, and of course the student is a minor, so the parents need to give you permission. And it's a simple release form, but you do want that before you go displaying it to people outside of the classroom. And in fact, if you email me, I can send you a release form. It's amb@littlebuffalolaw.com. And just remind me that I told you I would give you a release form for, it's just a video release. And then you're off.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes.
Hi.
No. I have a quick question.
Oh, no. Thank you.
If it's hard to be found on a movie, is it all right?
We've got a question about fair use. We have a project in class, follow fair use guidelines, 30 seconds of music. And now the kid wants to
but it's part
learn
of the
it
song.
And take it home.
Yeah. Are you charging admission for the parents that
no.
are coming to see it? Okay.
But then fair use guidelines, or is that
You know, here's the deal. When you say part of a song, is it really all just using a part of the song?
It's a copyrighted.
And some of it is on a song.
Yeah. You know, they're taking
a student did on it. school.
And you want them to take the work off. Right. That's exactly what it is. Project, you want to feel good about it.
They use someone else's music.
What you need to tell the children is that when you take it off, now you know that it might matter. When you give it in the classroom, it's okay. But when you show it to parents, that's okay. If they, like, even if you walk through this girl directly to you, and they show it, that. Is that what's copyrighted? Is that on the locker? It's not on the locker. It's going to be on the kids who put this together. Okay, because they're the ones who chose that piece of music. And then the question becomes, as I said, how much of the music are you making? Are you affecting the marketability? If I was your student and I had the opportunity to take it to the locker, I'd contact the writer of the song and get permission. Sometimes we think it's so hard to get permission, and it just isn't. At the very least, if your student sends a letter and requests permission, detailing exactly what the use is, because it isn't going to affect the marketability. Might even be handled. Very limited use. You make that effort. Even if you never get a response from the artist, now the student can say, look, I tried, okay?
Yeah.
And so that's my concern. Once it leaves your classroom, and then we want to see the effect.
Hope as an art teacher that we actually own copyright on all of our image artwork.
Not so. No, in fact, we didn't even cover that. The students don't have copyright in their own work. So even if you give them your idea, in fact, I do this all the time when I'm at the law, the copyright session. I say, okay, here's an idea. We're all going to write a high school about Halloween. And then I say, now, all of you just created copyright guidelines. I gave you a great idea. So what? Ideas are not copyright. Nope. They own their copyright, their own artwork. Yeah.
They have people that specifically are looking.
That sounds like a fun job.
Oh boy. I would start with your media specialist and ask them. They may already have a bunch of licensed music available. They do this. Okay. And that's just not that doesn't cover it.
Senior graduation, the video with all the pictures and Let's Cry and have all the music on for like a 5-minute presentation. One Shot Wonder presentations, community and graduations. Okay. Doing it. The kids have created the 5-minute senior video with music of our time for the question that was posed. But now, can you even do it? I mean,
I'm going to shake the question.
Okay, good.
Can I?
Where can she buy royalty-free music or buy? Where can she obtain royalty-free
music? Just type in, go to Google and type in Creative Commons music.
Creative Commons is a wonderful tagline to put with any of
Commons?
This
stuff. Creative Commons. Voluntary licensing scheme where people voluntarily giving up some or all of their copyright.
And particularly generous with regard to educational uses.
Yes. Yep. So like I do that a lot with my staff. So,
I'll
make sure my presentation. Anybody wants it?
I'd love to.
Just type in Creative Commons and then add the word music to it. Okay.
No, but I mean, I'm not even a lot of
one. Most of the
people are right across the room. So, right across the room. because I'm the coordinator for all 31 schools from Peckham to Webster to Mass. And I'm taking this as a topic that I talk about as a flagship to get them to do the art.
I do.
Other question I have is this.
That's it for this podcast. If you'd like to know more about CASEL's nationally acclaimed Graduate School Technology Leadership Program, its resources for school leaders and university educational administration programs, or any of its other activities, please visit the CASEL website, www.schooltechleadership.org. If you'd like to learn more about Dr. McLeod or access the various resources that he makes available to K-12 and post-secondary educators, please visit his website, www.scottmcleod.net, or his blog, www.dangerouslyirrelevant.org. Thanks for listening.